In November 2021 in Sussex in the UK, a female escort worker just disappeared. After a male suspect was identified, the police investigation discovered that another female escort had vanished 6 months earlier and was linked to the same man. The search for the bodies would focus on an area of remote farmland leased by the suspect, and police would soon build a picture of the horrors that had occurred there. This is what happens when a psychopathic predator preys on the vulnerable. This is the case of Mark Brown. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. The case I'm going to cover today is one that is shocking because it again reinforces the reality that when you're a sex worker, for some reason, your life doesn't receive the same type of attention that it deserves to receive. I'm highlighting these murders because of the fact that we need to pay more attention when sex workers go missing. We can't just imagine that they live transient lifestyles and therefore it's normal for them to disappear. This is what happens to the most vulnerable in our society, and we need to do better. It's as simple as. And also, we're looking at the case of Mark Brown, basically a serial killer, and likely a serial killer that you've never, ever heard of. Thank you so much for supporting me on Patreon, YouTube membership. Guys, I couldn't do this without you. Also, if you're thinking, what's the Serial Killer Next Door tour? It's my tour all across the UK. I'm at 80 venues, I think, this year. And if you'd like to come and see me, please do come and say hi, get a selfie at the end of the show. It's always a great deal of fun seeing you. You do have to put up with my really dark humour though. I do worry that some people come, have no idea who I am, think this will be interesting, be an academic lecture. And then there's me on stage, not being academic. So let's get on with today's case. So 34-year-old single mum of two, Alexandra Morgan. Now, she's better known as Alex, and I'll refer to her as Alex throughout this. She lived in Wilsley Pound, which is in Cranbrook, Kent, and she lived with her children. She's described as somebody who was really bright, she was energetic, she was a really young woman who was full of life. She'd been a former dog groomer, she had a really strong work ethic and she had a real drive to succeed. So she was somebody that was quite entrepreneurial. But first and foremost, like so many of us, she felt an absolute desire to bring her children up with what she could create in the best way possible. So her focus was all about providing the best life for her two very young sons. And because of that, she'd made a decision to essentially change her life a little bit and start working as an escort because it was a way of bringing in extra income. So even though she was somebody who qualified in dog grooming and somebody that had built a business in that respect, it didn't in her mind serve enough economic purpose to mean that she was thriving. So escort opportunities were something that could provide that extra income. Now, despite what I would say had been challenges in her life, she had faced challenges. She was really happy and she was very much doting on her boys. She was very much planning her future with her family. And she was always thinking ahead about how she could make her family life better. She was intrinsically focused on future protecting her life with her children by bringing in as much income as possible. And I think that we can all relate to that. We can all relate to how it feels when you can't put food on the table for your kids. We can all relate to how it feels to have to say no to children time and time and time again because your bank balance won't allow them the treats that their friends can have. It's very much a motivating factor when people make decisions about bringing extra income into the home, even when that extra income can pose a risk to them. Because we're also going to be honest, if you're a sex worker, your risk of being harmed increases exponentially. And it's not because you deserve that at all. But you can bet your bottom dollar that predators know that vulnerability. And we all know predators seek those who are available and vulnerable. And unfortunately, the desirability of sex workers in predators' frames of reference is enormous. So clearly, even though she's doing this for her family, she's also sacrificing her safety to some degree. Shouldn't be the case. Sex workers should be safe, but unfortunately, they aren't always safe. So we get to November 2021. She's planning this future. She's doing whatever she can to bring in money for the kids. Then she just vanishes. Literally vanishes. Now, the thing about Alex is, unlike some sex workers who potentially have dependency issues, they have a transience in their lifestyle, they move on from place to place, it's not like this for Alex. She's incredibly well-loved and very secure in the foundations within her family. So her parents instantly know that she's gone missing. So Jackie and Michael, who are her parents, they report her missing. So Kent's police's major crime unit, they start to commence the investigation into her disappearance. They know that this is highly out of character. She's totally devoted to her kids. There's no way that she would have disappeared of her own volition. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up, particularly when you bear in mind what I've told you already about why this woman is working so hard as a sex worker. It's for her children. It's for her family. She's not looking at an escape route. Quite the contrary. She's creating foundations that mean her children will have a better life. Now, the police are obviously investigating this immediately with a sense that something bad could have happened to her. And they're pretty instantly able to establish that there's a link to one of her male escort clients. This is 39-year-old former builder, Mark Brown. So instantly, they're suspicious of this guy. Now, on the face of it, Brown is your typical chameleon. Think BTK. Think the kind of person who can just fit into society and people don't necessarily believe they stand out in any negative way, shape or form. He's known as a family man. Of course he is. How often do we hear that? Particularly with organised offenders, tend to be very orientated to fitting in and being perceived with this mask of acceptability by those around him. He lived on Squirrels Close, which is in St. Leonard's-on-Sea, which is a lovely area in East Sussex. And he lived with his long-term partner, 44-year-old Lisa Clark. They also had three sons. That image, of course, as we know, total facade. In fact, he was an individual who ultimately was consistently unfaithful to her. And I would say that when you pull apart this mask that he wore, every single thing about his life was a facade. Now, he rented a barn, and that barn had outbuildings on the outskirts of Hastings. If you've ever been to Hastings, absolutely stunning. Very much famous for the Battle of Hastings. You don't know this about me, but I used to work in France. And I actually used to live just outside Bayeux. And I used to take them to see the tapestry there, which of course is all to do with the Battle of Hastings. Little bit of trivia there for you. But essentially it's a gorgeous area. And I'm not saying that crime doesn't happen in gorgeous areas. We all know it does. But certainly there's not an expectation that a serial killer could be on the loose, genuinely. The psychology of those areas, it does not resonate. So he has this place, these outbuildings on the outskirts of Hastings, and this is at the remote Little Bridge Farm. Sounds quite idyllic, doesn't it? The Little Bridge Farm. We certainly don't think, when we imagine that name, of envisaging a crime scene. Now, this is a place that he basically is meant to just work on cars. So he repairs them, he sells them, he kind of flips them, you know, gets them, does them up, makes a profit. But let's be real. His interest didn't lie in fixing cars, and the whole premise of him having the Little Bridge Farm and renting those outbuildings was nothing to do with him wanting to do a good service and provide the local community with vehicles that he'd done up. Absolutely not. That farm purely was there for a dual purpose. So he had the mask of acceptability, a reality of why he's there fixing these cars, but actually a far more malevolent reason behind his actions and reasons for being there. So he used this really old shipping container, and that shipping container was there for a specific reality, which is that that's where he met sex workers. His frequent liaisons would take place in the shipping container. And you can imagine how cold and how inhumane that environment is to actually have such an intimate experience. When you think about having sex, even with sex workers, because of the intimacy, we tend not to think about them being carried out in such desolate ways in things like shipping containers. We know that those things happen, but it's kind of incongruent with our understanding of sexual experience. But this is what he does. So there's no care or compassion aimed towards these women. It's just the cold, calculated action. It's gratifying himself in a place where people can't see him, no matter how cold and metallic the environment is. Now, he'd meet the escorts on adult websites. One of the online services that Brown used was adultwork.com. And this is where he first contacts Alex. So he gets in contact with Alex in June 2021. And it's so interesting, genuinely. Alex was clearly somebody with incredible intuition and instinct, but also she was somebody who was really articulate and bright. She was an individual who knew that she could potentially place herself at risk. And it's very rare that we find individuals bright enough to leave breadcrumb trails for investigators, but I genuinely feel that Alex did this. It's almost as if she left clues for them to find when the police actually go and search her home. For example, she'd left details of the place Brown worked as a security guard. She'd also left a note for her son, and the note said, "Let's go rollerblading." So when they searched in her son's bedroom, inside a box of rollerblades, the officers found £2,500 in cash, which is obviously money that she was saving from her sex work. But also, they found an old mobile phone that she'd used for the escort work. There was also a PIN code in it that was also in the box. So the officers have the PIN code, they have the phone. Again, think about this. This is a woman who's left that trail. You know, she knows the PIN code. She doesn't need to have that in the box for herself. She's left that because she obviously knows there's a chance that something may happen to her, and she wants investigators, she wants her family to know that should something befall her, there's a track back to how it occurred. So the officers obviously use the PIN, access the phone, and in it, there's these screenshots of a series of messages that have been sent to her by Brown. So they included this discussion about this big money-making scheme that he was presenting her with. I mean, it sounded far too good to be true, and I have no doubt whatsoever that Alex would have thought that it potentially was too good to be true. And it's right, because this is all about weaving a trap for Alex. So this presentation that there's this get-rich-quick scheme that she's obviously uncertain of, this is actually weaving a web around her. Now, another note that officers found, it actually said that if anything happened to her, so bear this in mind, she's actually predicting a possibility of her demise. And she's written, check postcode TN345NY, Rock Lane, opposite Bartlett's. And that's the location of Little Bridge Farm. Like I say, this is a breadcrumb trail leading the investigators to her killer. So investigators now have something really solid. They're able to establish that Alex had met with Brown before several occasions. They'd had sex on several occasions. This was both at her home, it was at Little Bridge Farm. And the first time actually was at Alex's home. This was on the 8th of June, 2021. And later on that month, they had sex at the Little Bridge Farm. They met on another seven occasions. That was between August and September. However, 23rd of October 2021, so around 5 months after they first met, Brown sends her this text about this get-rich-quick scheme, and it's offering this risk-free opportunity, £100,000 for just 3 to 5 days' work. So the whole premise of this is he sorted out this escorting job at a hotel. He works there as a night security guard. So he's got this guise of possibility. There are these clients. They want you to come and have sex with them. You're going to have to be available 3 to 5 days. You're going to get this huge amount of money. Now for Alex, even though we can see from her historical leaving of this trail that invites the investigators to be able to find out what happened to her. You can imagine, can't you? She's really saving up for her kids. She's got £2,500 in the rollerblade box. This is somebody with a plan to raise funds. Suddenly she's being presented with this amazing opportunity with a guy that she's had regular sex with over a period of time. Nothing untowards occurred. And he's now saying there's £100,000 for you. Just come and spend time at this hotel. You wouldn't be able to feel anything other than small amount of excitement. Even if you were worried, even you had trepidation about this, the reality is you'd be thinking to yourself, wow, this could be a game changer. I could make some really good money for my family. I could change my kids' lives. And what's really sad about this and about this genuine human motivation to create something incredible for the people that she loved, she instantly starts Googling things like minimum deposit for a house in 2021. So her immediate thought is, I can use this, I can change the outcome of my family's life. She even searched information about setting up a sunbed business. So again, that entrepreneurial spirit, it's flowing through her veins. And it's both her friend, because of course, when you're an entrepreneur, it means that you can create amazing things in your world. Sometimes they go wrong, but you keep going. You have that aspiring belief system within your psyche. But it's also her enemy in this situation, because it's that desire to make a better life. It's that desire to push forward and come good for her family that actually means that she agrees to go and get involved with Brown's manipulative plan. And again, this is all evidence of Brown's organization, isn't it? This is a man who knows that now he's built a relationship with this woman. She's trusting him, even though she may think that this scheme he's come up with seems a little bit far out. The logistics of his behaviour has been enough for her to start thinking, well, maybe. What's the worst that can happen? Maybe I won't make all that money, but maybe I'll make some money. So he exploits this vulnerability, and it's all about exerting control over her. It's all about breaking those defences down so that she genuinely believes that she can trust him. We get to Remembrance Sunday, 14th of November 2021. Alex leaves her children and her dog with her parents, and she says that she's going to this spa with her friends. She's going to go away for a 4-day trip. Now, bear in mind again, why has he created a 4 to 5 day opportunity for her? Clearly, because he wants time. This is a man who doesn't want people being alerted to her disappearance quickly. He wants time. So by making her believe that she's going to go somewhere for a period of time and legitimizing that with the people who love her, no one's looking for her, he can have her at his will. Now, in truth, we obviously know that Brown had no intention of her going on that trip. And as far as she's concerned, she's not going for a spa. She's going to the hotel where she thinks she's going to be spending several days servicing whoever Brown has brought for her. 7:20 a.m. that morning, Alex is actually captured on CCTV. She's buying fuel at Ashwell Garage. This is in Cranbrook, local to her. Now, just before 8 a.m., we see her Mini Cooper being caught entering the track to Littlebridge Farm. It's actually directly following in Brown's gold Jag. It's the last time there's any sighting of her alive. No one ever sees her alive again. Now, Alex never left the farm. But Brown did. Brown left the farm later on that afternoon in his Jag. He then returned in a white work van. This is shortly after 10 p.m. And then he leaves in Alex's Mini around 12:35 a.m. And that Mini was later found abandoned in Holmhurst Lane, St. Leonard's. Also had false number plates on it. We can imagine, can't we? Somebody like Brown is going to have access to number plates because he's constantly working on cars. But that's very manipulative, and that's very organized as well, because essentially people will be looking for her car. But the fact that he's changed the plates, that could throw off the investigators, at least at the very beginning when they're looking for her. So he knows what he's doing. Now, the same day that Alex was last seen alive, Brown actually calls his partner and asks her to bring him a bottle of bleach. And of course, his partner's not going to be thinking that anything untoward is happening. At the end of the day, I'm sure there are lots of things that he would need bleach for at that particular premises. And then we see him at 9:52 p.m. He buys £10 worth of diesel from a petrol station, but he doesn't put the diesel in the van itself, no. He puts the fuels into jerry cans and then places them in the back of the van. Instantly, we can all imagine what he's thinking of doing with those cans of fuel. When they investigate Alex's mobile cell data as well, they're able to actually note that her last movements had been at and around the location of the Little Bridge farm. So they even are essentially drawn directly to note that she was there and that her cellular communication at that point seemed to be last noted at Little Bridge Farm. So when she fails to return home on the Wednesday to collect her sons, immediately her parents are completely concerned. They know this is completely out of character. She would never fail to pick her children up. So they end up contacting the police and they report her missing the following day. This is the 18th of November, 2021. And they must have been so concerned because this is desperately out of character. This is not how Alex behaves. And I think for anybody who loves anybody, when you feel that the habits haven't been followed, when you feel that a particular arrangement has been broken, and it's just not the type of thing that they do regularly, you can't help but have that horrible feeling of dread in your belly. I'm sure that for some of us, the reality will have occurred where we've had that intuition and instinct about something and it hasn't played out how it should. And actually it's because something quite terrible has occurred consequentially. And her parents feel that way. Now, as I've said, what is really telling about this scenario is Alex must have suspected that something could happen to her when she visited Brown that last time. She quite possibly, in my opinion, sensed something just wasn't right about him. So first of all, the fact that she knew that she could have been in danger, that it led her to actually leave this trail. She wants police to know about Brown. She wants them to know that there is something that potentially he has the power to do to her. And even though she's probably hoping that this is just something that she's overthinking and overanalyzing, and we do that, of course we do. Often if something feels too good to be true, it is too good to be true. And even if it is true, we'll often think ourselves into so many different corners, imagining, well, what if it isn't? And she probably did that, but ultimately thought to herself, you know what? Seen this guy before, at the end of the day, I'm probably just being over anxious. I need to go, but I'm just going to ensure for my own sense of safety and self that should anything happen to me, he's not going to get away with it. And because of the clues she left, investigators are able to establish the last known movements. And that's so important because they can literally track her leaving home to arriving with Brown at Little Bridge Farm, 20 miles away. She basically became her own detective from beyond the grave. So on the 23rd of November 2021, this is when the police swoop in, they cordon off the farm, they've got their main suspect, it's as simple as that. So when Brown arrives, he ends up speaking to the officers, and of course he's very compliant because this is what these psychopathic killers are like. Oh, I'm very compliant, I'm very nice, I'm very helpful. Can we have your DNA? Of course you can have my DNA. I have nothing to hide. Are you sure you don't have anything to hide? You know I've got something to hide. I know I've got something to hide, but I'm going to play a game where we pretend that I think I'm just being a really nice guy and being helpful, because that's what innocent people do. Actually, it's what guilty people do as well. I know that, you know that, but we're all going to play this game just a little bit longer. That kind of thing. So, of course, he agrees to give his DNA and he agrees to give sample fingerprints as well. And that's really important. Of course it is, because they want to be able to tie him to the crime. But of course, Brown is one step ahead as far as he is concerned because of his superior and arrogant and narcissistic personality. He's thinking, I know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say that I did meet Alex. I met Alex for sex on the day that she just happened to disappear. That was it, though. I had sex with her. She left after 45 minutes. Now, again, we've seen this in prior cases where the killer will absolutely admit a truth to hopefully deny the crime. So here he is building this picture of, well, sure, got nothing to hide. Okay, I slept with a prostitute, I slept with a sex worker, but hey, no big deal, these things happen. By the way, where's she gone? Because as far as I'm concerned, she left well and healthy after 45 minutes. And also, bear in mind, he's created this map of possibility at this point because they've met on several occasions. So if they've met on several occasions, arguably he can say, well, why would I kill her on this occasion? We've met for consensual paid sex regularly. Why would I kill her today? Now we all know because he's been manipulating her into a position where she believes that he's potentially not a malevolent killer. He's not somebody that she has to fear massively. He's not acted in a way in prior experience that meant that she thought she would absolutely be murdered if she turned up that day. Why would she have turned up otherwise? But he's set this trap over time, but he's using that in his defense. Why would I kill her? We've met regularly for sex. But of course, the great thing about technology is that, one, it's way more intelligent than Brown, literally. This guy is totally over-exaggerating his intelligence and his ability to escape these kind of implications. Because, first of all, they're going to be able to track her phone. And his account simply doesn't match the evidence that I've already gone through so far. Her car leaving, etc., without her. Now, the following day, he actually goes up to his boss and his colleagues and he actually tells them that the police are at the farm and then says he was going to be arrested soon for a double murder. I kid you not. Literally tells his colleagues and boss, yeah, I'm going to be going down for double murder soon. Essentially immediately admitting the reality of his actions. He even said, I'll be going away for 25 years to life. I'm going to have to go down for this one, 25 years to life. Now, that in itself demonstrates a level of stress, doesn't it? Because you're not articulate forensically in any way, shape or form if you're actually admitting to your colleagues and to your boss that you've killed people. Also, lack of boundaries, massive lack of boundaries. The last thing that you were going to do is to create a whole heap of witnesses because they've listened to you take reality of accepting that you have carried out this crime. Doesn't make sense. But as I said, stress is interesting. When we see killers under stress, often it leads to them killing more if they have the opportunity, or it leads to them doing things like this, which is where chaos starts to present itself into their psyche. So then we get to the 25th of November, 2021. At this point, understandably, because there's literally a map to his guilt by the victim and also through the technological wonder of mobile technology and CCTV, he gets arrested on suspicion of Alex's murder and at this point is questioned in his home. But of course, he's going to go for the obvious. Even though I've told all my mates at work that I did it, I'm just going to deny it. I don't know where she is. I don't know what you're talking about. So he's having one dialogue with people that he knows and one dialogue with the actual investigation. So as part of the investigation into Alex's disappearance, they start forensically investigating Brown. So they search Brown's work van. And in it, wow, it's something they're not expecting. So they discover prescription medication for somebody totally different. 32-year-old mother of three, Leah Ware. Now, she's from Hastings, East Sussex. Now, again, she's another female escort worker. So the Kent police at this point are like, why is this guy who's now a suspected murderer, who's undoubtedly in connection with the disappearance of this other escort worker, why has he got this medication? There's a prescription medication that needs to be picked up for Leah Ware. So the Kent police, they contact the Sussex Constabulary because they want to inquire if Leah's been reported missing. Ironically, she hadn't. But it's not enough for them to feel safe that she's actually present still. Instead, they feel that they need to dig a little bit deeper, and it doesn't take long at all to discover that she hadn't actually been seen or heard from since May 2021. That's 6 months earlier. Just disappeared off the face of the earth 6 months earlier. So immediately, second missing persons investigations launched. And at this point, they're thinking, we're not just dealing with an individual murderer. This could be a double homicide. Now, what was Leah like? Okay, so her mother described her as kind, intelligent. She's very loving to everyone. That's her mother, Rebecca Martin. And she really did feel that as a young person growing up, that she was an infinitely compassionate girl. But unfortunately, she had her demons, she had her issues. And actually, she started with some very serious mental health issues. This included bipolar disorder. Some of you might know that as manic depression. That's what we used to call it in the olden days when I was younger. But bipolar depression, so obviously suffering from depression and mania. Also, she suffered from dependency during her life. And those issues actually led to her losing custody of her daughter and two sons, which would have been incredibly painful. No matter who you are and what you're facing and what your mental health is, to lose the custody of your children is incredibly challenging emotionally. Also, it's worth noting that she had been on track with respect to getting her life back. And more importantly, she'd been really working hard to regain custody of her children. Now, again, what strikes me, and I'm sure that it will strike a lot of you, is how can, therefore, this woman who had been struggling with her mental health, yes, and with some dependency issues, but really was working towards getting her children back, and then she just disappears and nobody reports her missing? It's one of the frustrations I have, and this isn't coming down on her family at all. I appreciate when you're dealing with somebody who's severely mentally unwell, somebody who also additionalizes that because they're self-medicating their pain with drugs and dependency issues, it can be incredibly upsetting, frustrating, and scary, and sometimes not seeing them can feel like the easier path to take. But when somebody is in such dire straits and such dire need, particularly when they've been working hard to get their life back on track, I just think checking in with them regularly, particularly when they work in precarious ways, I think that that is essential. So even if you are frustrated as hell with somebody, don't remove your love fully, don't remove your support fully. Everybody needs a springboard. Everybody needs a foundation, somewhere to fall. And we can't allow these individuals to just disappear in our society without thinking that we have a level of responsibility and accountability to check in on them. And don't get me wrong, that's not a judgment on her family at all. It's so commonplace when people have these difficulties, but it's just one of those reminders that even though a human being can fall, even though their vulnerability can take over and make knowing them difficult, it's still worth thinking, are they safe? Because people like Brown can go ahead and kill again because she hadn't even been notably acknowledged as having disappeared. So at this point, Brown, thank God, is detained by police because this kind of a character is incredibly dangerous, but carries on denying the involvement. Were you involved in the murder? I was not involved in the murder. Why then is her car seen leaving your place without her in it? I was not involved in the murder. Why is literally all of the telecommunications saying that she was at your place and then it just stops communicating when she was at your place? I was not involved in the murder. Why did she literally leave clues so that we could literally get you and know that you were the person who basically murdered her? I'm gonna say it again. I was not involved in the murder. We don't care, because she was so effective at proving your guilt that you can say that for a zillion years, and we're gonna make sure that the cell next to you involves somebody very, very scary who doesn't like people who like to hurt women at all. Just throwing it out there. I know that's not professional, but it's gonna happen. Anyway. He's saying no, don't know anything about it. But the investigators can quickly tell that not only had he been involved with Alex, he'd also been involved with Leah, that actually been having an affair, a full-blown relationship before she disappeared. And she'd actually been living in the outbuildings on Little Bridge Farm. So he's basically banged to rights. They can link him directly to this woman. They can link the fact that she was actually living in the outbuildings. Now, when they traced back how they met, Brown basically contacted Leah through the adultwork.com website, so the same one that he met Alex on. This is in March 2018. His username there was FistyMC, which I don't know. When I think about FistyMC and I put it in context with an adult sex network, I worry about what his particular predilections and intentions were. FistyMC. Anyway, initially he'd paid her for sex, as he'd done with other escorts before her. But it seems like their acquaintance developed into what I would consider is an on-off roller coaster relationship. So there's a lot of toxicity in it. Bear in mind, the time that we're talking about these two meeting, Leah is really vulnerable. Brown knew that and he loved it, because if you're vulnerable, you can exploit it. And he wanted to exploit her. He wanted to use her. He wanted to control her. So in December 2018, this relationship has got to a point where he even rents a flat for Leah. This is in a place called Guestling in East Sussex. And he actually paid the deposit and he also paid the first 6 months' rent. Leah, during this period, even referred to him as her sugar daddy. And apparently he called her princess in their communication. And she ends up moving out of that flat after the lease expires in June 2019. And at this point, their relationship is still going on. So Brown then moves her onto Little Bridge Farm. Now, she would be within his full control now. You know, he's paid for her to live in that flat. They've developed a relationship. She's got a reliance on him. And even though she's now going from a flat to actually living on the grounds of Little Bridge Farm, it still is something that is going to be favourable to her because she's got this relational experience with him. Now, bear in mind, he moves her onto this Little Bridge Farm even though the terms of his lease stipulated that no one could live there. Now, initially, he places a caravan on there, but this has to be removed. And apparently, because it had to be removed, Brown decided that he would burn it. We know what we say about people who like burning things. Think about the McDonald Triad. Think about cases like Son of Sam, 1400 fires in New York, David Berkowitz. And also think about the way that the McDonald Triad is set up, the reality as we see pyromania as part of that. I'm not saying this guy's always setting fire to things, but I'm just telling you, if I had a caravan and somebody said, yeah, she can't live in the caravan on that site, I'd think I'll auto-trade it. Maybe I'll Facebook marketplace it. Who knows? I may turn a small profit. I wouldn't think, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to set it on fire. That would never occur to me. Unless I had a penchant for destroying things. Or maybe I wanted a practice ground to see how things burn. But this is how he removes it. And the reality is, as far as I'm concerned, that's because he knows that fire is an effective method of destruction. And I think it's probably something he's used before. So at this point, even though she's not meant to live on that farm at all, she needs somewhere to stay. So basically, she moves into an old shipping container, which is located on the land. I mean, how vulnerable, how lonely, and how isolated are you when you get into a scenario where it's preferable to move into a cold, old shipping container that's on the land? Now, whatever the relationship was between those two, it was abusive and it was coercive, and it was one that she absolutely did not control. Brown was the person who was controlling of Leah. And to put this in context, to give you an example of why I can say that without any doubt whatsoever, when he was at work, he would keep her locked in the barn or in the shipping container, just like you might treat an animal that you're mistreating. She was his object for pleasure. She was his object for gratification sexually. She would do his will. It was as simple as that. He'd managed to manipulate her into that position. And remember what we're talking about here. We're talking about a mother of three, a woman with mental health issues, a vulnerable individual, and he knows exactly how to exploit her. Another thing about Leah that really resonates with me, she absolutely loved animals. So when she's at Little Bridge Farm, Brown basically encourages her to stay there and he buys her a small menagerie, I suppose you could say, of animal companions. I don't know, a little bit like I have done for myself. One of the things that you would say when you come into my house is Emma an animal hoarder? The jury's out. They're treated very well, but I do have a lot of them. Sometimes there are moments in my life where I'll think, you maybe went a little bit OTT. Nonetheless, I adore them, and they're preferable to many humans in my opinion. Not you guys, obviously. I adore you guys. But this is how he ties her into that space. He gets her all these gorgeous little animals that she loves. She's got two dogs, which she just doted on, by the way. She was an absolutely lovely animal mama. She had a Pomeranian called Lady, and Lady was her absolute devoted best friend. She followed her everywhere, and she also had a mastiff called Duke. They also had goats, and she had a horse called Bertie. And the whole premise of this is to create a world where she stays at the farm, but also where she does have some company. So even though it's isolated, it doesn't feel completely isolated because she has this amazing animal family. Now, it doesn't surprise any of you to know that my position here is that Brown treated Leah as her property, just like the animals. She's just another being there. Whatever he wants to do with those beings is up to him. He can do whatever he pleases with her. So he makes her dependent on him, first of all. You know, we know this. She's now living there. She's got the animals there. How else is she going to cope? How else was she going to eat? These are all things that a coercive controller absolutely ensure occurs. And also, she's now incredibly submissive. And Brown likes that. So when it comes to sex, she does what he asks. And he does things that she doesn't enjoy. So he gags her, he restrains her, and she actually confided in her friends that he wanted to do things like take pictures of her in the boot of a car. Bear in mind, killers often live in fantasy. Just because when he's asking to take pictures of her in the car, he's not actually murdered her, that doesn't mean that he isn't pumping the fantasy within his head, within his mindset. It doesn't mean that he isn't creating this amplification of feelings around the potential for harming her. And obviously she feels uneasy about the fact that he wants to take these pictures of her in the boot of the car. And also, when the police start to look at his searches online, I mean, the phrases are awful. Beaten, rape, gangbang, forced and brutal are the things that he searches for. It's so indicative of what's actually going on in his head. This girl isn't somebody he loves. This isn't a woman that he wishes to protect. This is a woman that ultimately he's been able to deconstruct to a position where he can do what he likes. And it feels as if what he likes isn't enough any longer. He wants to take it to another level. Ted Bundy described that as the tipping off point. And he's getting to that tipping off point where Leah is concerned. And bear in mind, we've also seen those typical traits of abusive individuals. You know, he isolated Leah from her support network. He used vulnerability to retain control of her. And on top of this, he even claims carer's allowance in relation to her. So he's making money from her. She's just an object to be exploited. And again, what do we know about psychopaths, sociopaths? We know that that's how they see people. How do I get what I want from you? Doesn't matter how it hurts you. Doesn't matter the amount of distress it causes. Doesn't matter if it ends in you dying. What matters is I get to bleed you dry. And Brown is absolutely an individual who has that mindset. Now, Leah, she disappeared around the 7th of May, 2021. 6 months before Alex vanished. And what's really sad, there's still no trace of her to this day. So her family have never been able to bring her home. Now, the last outbound communication from her phone, that was at 8:55 a.m. on the day that she vanished. And the police think that that was the day that she was likely to have been killed by Brown. At that point, her phone was disconnected from the network. And they said it was done in a disorderly shutdown method. So obviously it didn't seem to be that the person who was the owner of the phone was doing it. And that happened later that day that she apparently disappeared. Now, investigators believe that that's when it coincided with her basically entering the shipping container, because that would have been on the farm and that place had absolutely no reception. Now, the following day, it kept disconnecting, reconnecting, disconnecting. And this was from 8:57 a.m. in the morning, but then it gets to 2:38 in the afternoon and it gets manually switched off at that point. Now, one of the things that the investigators know about Leah is there's absolutely no way that she would have left without her dogs. So the investigators start to track what happened to her dogs, because this is something that she would never have been separated from. So the investigators are able to establish that after she vanished, Brown basically rehomes Leah's Mastiff, Duke. Now, think about that. This is a girl who was obsessed with her animals. It tied her to that awful place that she was staying because they were her family. And yet Brown has now rehomed her beloved Duke with his own sister. So we know that she isn't coming back, don't we? He knows that she's not coming back. Why else would he have rehomed the dog? And another thing that Brown does is he sends a text to an old school friend that he's recently become reacquainted with, a woman called Elizabeth Howard, and it read like this. I'm going to be very careful how I word this. It happened again. Not very long ago when disposing of something. It's a very unpleasant thing to do. An old oil drum, 5 litres of diesel, and hey presto, there's not very much left. Gets hot, very hot. Glows almost white. The things I've done lay heavily on my heart, on my head, and on my soul. A psychopath with a conscience. It's a joke, really. So many things that you could unpack there, isn't it? First of all, the fact that he says it happened again. What insight are we being shown there? Is this a killer of one person, of two persons, or is this a killer of many? So many that he can actually text somebody and say, it happened again? And the fact that he talks about having a conscience where it lays heavy, his knowledge of what his actions have been, on his mind, and the fact that he thinks that that would mean he was a psychopath with a conscience. Not at all. Just because a psychopath can carry out actions and has less empathy to no empathy, and certainly less communication of the areas regarding pro-social behaviour and an understanding of guilt and shame, it doesn't mean that you don't have the ability to feel a level of reflection and understanding that what you've done is wrong. You can absolutely feel that, just by no means enough to stop you carrying out a heinous action. So you can acknowledge that by society's standards it's wrong. Hey, you can even acknowledge that you've stolen a mother from her children. And that can kind of irk you or upset you a little, but not enough to prevent you from taking the action. A psychopath doesn't have a conscience like you or I. A psychopath has a conscience that allows them to carry out these malevolent, despicable acts and to continue with their lives, even though they may occasionally pay attention to the reality of their actions. Now, as I said, whatever things Brown's actually referring to in that text, it feels like one of the things that he's looking for at this point is a confidant. You know, he doesn't want to express genuine remorse, but what he really wants to do is reveal his true, darker nature. He wants to share his exploits, as far as I'm concerned, and it worries me that he has a level of comfort in telling this Elizabeth these thoughts and feelings. It worries me that he felt that potentially she would be on side with him, that she would hear these things and not react with the aversion that 99.9% of us would react with. Because let me tell you, if I got a text of an old schoolmate, okay, we've got history, you used to know them when they were a kid, you used to like them when they were a kid, and then they're sending me things suggesting that they burn things and they've done it again, and it's kind of dark, I'm going to be like, I'm not going to be meeting Brown for our regular coffee, because I think potentially he's a massive psychopath. Just throwing it out there, Elizabeth, it's probably best to break these kind of communication issues off with somebody like this. So he also says to her, I've done monstrous things, but I couldn't do anything to you. You deserve better than me. You're amazing. But of course, we also know that just because somebody texts something like this to somebody suggesting that they've never hurt them, that would not exonerate them in any way, shape or form from harm. And also, Elizabeth, make better choices in the kind of people you communicate with. I'm not going to charge you for that information. Just throwing it out there. Make better choices. He also goes on to tell Elizabeth that Leah had been his soulmate, but that she'd taken her own life and that she was now at peace. Can you see what's happening here? This is him clearing space, isn't it? I don't know who Elizabeth is, but he's decided that he's going to fixate and obsess on her a little bit. At the end of the day, that means that he has to explain why Leah is no longer in his world, and he's going to make himself a bit of a hero, a bit of a broken hero. At the end of the day, Leah took her own life. She's at peace now, but how sad I am, and so on and so forth. I'm going to create a vulnerability in myself so that you feel sorry for me, so you can reach into me, so that you can be more attracted to me. He's even using the murder of Leah disguised as a suicide to try to ingratiate himself and make himself more attractive to Elizabeth. Now, Brown, when he's asked about his relationship with Leah, because obviously she's been around for a relatively long period of time in his life, so he goes on to give loads of conflicting explanations to his friends, to his neighbours, about why Leah has just disappeared into thin air. So he tells some people that she'd been admitted into psychiatric hospitals in the Sussex area, and they understandably are like, oh, okay, cool, which one, so that we can go visit her? He's like, I haven't thought that far ahead. So even though they have admitted her, it turns out you're not allowed to visit. Not sure that's how hospital works. I am telling you now, the psychiatric ward that Leah's being placed in have a no visiting rule at all. I don't think that they do that unless you're in solitary confinement in prison. They have made that rule. Just back off. So he's already telling porky pies that make absolutely no sense whatsoever, and basically hoping that they'll just buy into this idea that they're not allowed to see her. Like, that ever happens when you're a patient. Also then goes and tells other friends of hers that she'd gone off with travellers. She's gone to join the fair. She's going to be on the waltzers. I mean, again, makes absolutely no sense, but clever in the context of the transient lifestyle that would occur when working with, for example, showman travellers who obviously move from place to place because they're putting on the fares. But again, her mobile cell site data placed her last movements at the farm and around the Little Bridge Farm. So they know she's never gone anywhere. Why wouldn't she have taken her phone? Why wouldn't she have taken her beloved dogs? Literally makes no sense whatsoever. But again, we're getting that insight into an individual who genuinely thinks that he can outsmart everyone. He's got that little value of human life, and certainly that little value of sex workers, that because he doesn't value them, he's genuinely surprised when people care. When people think, what's happened to Leah or what's happened to Alex? They're not stories he's expecting to unfold. Within a month, literally a month of Leah's disappearance, this woman that apparently is his soulmate, that he's actually sharing with Elizabeth, she's my soulmate, but unfortunately she died and she was admitted to a psychiatric unit after death, and then she ran off with showman travellers after then. And so on and so forth. Even though he's created all this ridiculous story and narrative around why Leah is no longer present in his life, even though he's meant to be broken, because of course you would be broken, particularly if your soulmate had died, turns out he just, you know, within a few weeks, rejoins adultwork.com network. I don't know about you. Seems like an absolutely normal thing when the love of your life has disappeared. Just join the escort network so that you can engage with some other escorts, for example. But that's what he does. So again, we're seeing a man who has plotted as a predator to create an opportunity to get his prey. He's had his prey for a period of time. He's now killed and disposed of that prey, and he's looking for his next victim. And this is unfortunately where Alex's path crosses with him. So police at this point are absolutely convinced they are dealing with a man who murdered both women 6 months apart. We get to the 28th of November 2021, and amen, Brown is charged with Alex's murder. Now, they don't have a body at this point, and that can make things very difficult. We can all agree circumstantial evidence, no matter how powerful, can be problematic for the CPS to press charges with. Now, that physical evidence they desperately want, unfortunately, when they search a building site in Sevenoaks, Kent, this is somewhere that Brown's carried out groundworks for. It's a local construction company that he's worked for at the time of Alex's disappearance. So they go over as the police, speak to the landowner, and it transpires that Brown had actually asked the landowner if he could put something in a skip at the site. So that really pricks their concern. And also, it excites them because they're thinking, okay, he thinks he's clever, but there's a strong possibility he's tried to create distance between himself and the killing, but he's done it at a place that we can actually have access to, that we can forensically start to investigate. So the 1st of December 2021, the police search the skip and also, in that moment, discover that an oil barrel's been dumped in it. And in the barrel, there's a plastic bag. And in that plastic bag, there's items which included a hairdryer, a pair of hair straighteners. So they send these away to get the DNA testing. And of course, when the testing comes back, they conclude it's Alex's DNA on them. Bear in mind, of course, Alex had been thinking she was going away for a few days. She would have packed these items because she would have wanted to be presentable during the hotel stay that she'd believed and been convinced that she was going on. And then the police find a second oil barrel. And at this point, they can tell this has been really severely burnt. Just think about how in keeping that is with Brown and his past behaviour with the caravan. He likes to burn things. And even though it's been really badly incinerated, inside they actually managed to find several small fragments, about the size of a fingernail. Transpires they're pieces of bone and several teeth. And a forensic odontologist later identified the teeth as belonging to missing Alex. He is bang to rights. Basically, Brown had turned that oil barrel into a homemade incinerator. Remember what he wrote to Elizabeth about it burning so bright it was almost white? So after he killed Alex, it looks like he burned a body, and that was absolutely in an attempt to destroy all the evidence. And his text to his friend Elizabeth, that means it had a far greater significance. An old oil drum, 5 litres of diesel, and hey presto, there's not very much left. It's exactly what he wrote. Now, other items which belong to Alex, they're also found in the skip. This included her jewellery, and also they were able to find her car key. It was found in a crisp packet in a digger on the farm. So even though he'd got rid of lots of her items, he kept that. Again, what do we know about these killers wanting a mementos? And the fact that her key is found in a crisp packet? Certainly. That's so he can revisit it, isn't it? Now, following the discovery of Alex's remains, police then start to suspect that Leah was likely to have suffered a similar fate. So her missing persons inquiry then becomes a major murder investigation. Meanwhile, faced with the discovery of Alex's remains, Brown decides that of course he's going to change his story. Oh, hang on a minute. You've found the remains. Yeah, we've found the remains, indicating that you, without a doubt, burnt the body of Alex after killing her. I have had some time to think about that story, and I would like to change it because now I'm going to have to tell you that I did actually bear witness to Alex dying, but I wasn't involved in the dying. No, she just had a catastrophic incident at the farm. And I thought, well, I could ring an ambulance. I could do that. Or I could just dispose of her body by burning her in a homemade incinerator. Does that resonate with you as a potential story? Just throwing it out there. No, it doesn't, you massive murderer. But anyway, that's what he says. Yes, apparently, according to Brown, she'd slipped on tools in his workshop. I don't know about you lot, I've slipped on things. I fell over on my arse. I've hit my back on the ground. I've done those things. I'm a certain age. I've been around quite a while. There's been a lot of opportunities for me to come a cropper. But when I've slipped, you could never describe me slipping and being seen hurtling through the air like a cartoon character slipping on a banana skin. Quote. Just think about that. You fall over on some tools. You're not going to go flying through the air unless, I don't know, somebody has prankwise placed an airbag from a car and you land on that and that's how you end up there. Or maybe you land on a trampoline embedded in the floor. Then I'll give you, you might hurtle through the air a little bit. Ain't gonna happen if you're just falling over somebody's tools. But apparently she hurtles through the air. And then as she lands, she strikes her head, suffering, quote, catastrophic injuries. This is absolute fabrication from the Disney cartoon book of potential accidents. So Brown then says that even though she's had this catastrophic head injury after flying through the air, he basically says that he administered first aid and CPR. But as he couldn't save a life, instead of bothering to inform the police and emergency services, he panics, burns the body. Again, gonna throw it out there. He's not really thinking this through, because Brown, you don't panic and burn somebody's body. Panic says that you're immediately doing things that are regretful. That's what panic does. Panic doesn't make you intricately plan how you're going to remove a corpse and then burn it to a point where hopefully no one's ever going to discover any of the remains, thus removing any potential for her family to say goodbye as well. That's not what panic does. That's cool, calm, calculated disrespect and disregard for a corpse that you then literally deride in so many ways. It's unbelievable. He completely extinguishes her humanity in those actions. So the idea that this is something that he hadn't planned and that he was panicking over, it does not ring true, and psychologically is not in any way, shape or form conducive to what he's describing on an emotional level. So Brown, of course, carries on denying murder. He's thinking to himself, I can get away with this if I just make out it's a horrible accident. They haven't actually got a body. The evidence that I've done anything horrible to them. Maybe I just did lose my mind and burn her. Also, he's saying that I didn't have anything to do with Leah's disappearance. So he's not even acknowledging that he'd been involved with her tragic accident like he's claiming for Alex. But anyway, they go and search Littlebridge Farm again, and they're able to find skeletal remains of Leah's Pomeranian. So that beautiful Pomeranian lady that was always by her side, they found the remains lying next to a lake. And that little dog's remains were attached to a 12 kilogram dumbbell weight with a chain. Basically, he'd executed that dog. He'd rehomed Duke, but he'd executed Lady. Lady was the one that was always with Leah. It's almost like it wasn't just enough to kill her. He wanted to literally execute the things of meaning towards her. Now, he went on to the police and said, yeah, you'll find those remains, because actually Leah drowned her own beloved dog. Again, you can just see, can't you? He's trying to grasp at straws. He's clutching at the possibilities of explaining away these obvious links to the malevolence in his nature. Investigators are also able to establish that Brown really went out of his way to try to make out that Leah was alive. Why would he do that? If she was in a psychiatric ward, or she'd left with travellers, or she was somebody who'd OD'd, all these stories he'd shared, why would he try so hard to make out that she was still alive and in regular contact locally? Because he used to go and collect her medication and her benefits payments. That's about signs of life. That's about making it seem that she is still within the locality. Also, he'd go and withdraw cash from her bank accounts. This is all after her disappearance, and that's all caught on CCTV. But he's doing it to try to prevent people being thrown onto the reality that she has actually physically disappeared. And he knows this. And yet, for whatever reason, he still thinks he can deny all of this away. So we get to the 1st of February 2022. Now, bear in mind, they haven't actually got Leah's body, but they feel that the evidence is so substantial that they can actually charge him with Leah's murder. When he was interviewed, as every innocent person always does during an interview, he says, no comment. Literally, I don't think that should be allowed. I just don't think that should be allowed. I genuinely don't. I think no comment should not be your right. Seriously. I'm all for saying you shouldn't speak to anybody without a solicitor. And actually, you shouldn't speak to anybody without a solicitor who's briefed you on how to respond. Because you can respond minimally. I don't know. So on and so forth. But to just say no comment in a protective measure to try to defend yourself, it's so guilt-inspiring as far as I am concerned. I actually think you should just get fast-tracked to prison. It's as simple as that. Then we get to the 17th of December 2022. Brown's trial commences at Hove Crown Court. Now, bear in mind, previously, he'd pleaded not guilty to both of the charges. He said that Alex has died of this tragic accident, head had cracked open on an angle iron, apparently. And of course, he's claiming that Leah is still alive, so he hasn't got a case to answer there. So he said that the reasoning, because of course the prosecution would be like, well, why were you collecting all of her medication, etc., if you weren't involved with her anymore? And he's like, okay, I did do that because I was actually collecting a prescription of money and leaving it for her in a horse box on Little Bridge Farm. Wasn't she in a psychiatric unit? After she was out, wasn't she travelling with showmen, going around the country doing fairs? After she'd finished? It's making no sense. Send him to the tower, leave him there for a million years. Anyway, this is the absolute BS he's coming out with. So they have this 7-week trial. It takes more than 2 days of deliberation. Bear in mind, it's not easy to convict somebody if there is not a body. It's circumstantial. It really is circumstantial, and that's problematic for a jury. So understandably, they're taking it very seriously. And that 2 days of deliberation, wow, imagine the family, imagine how you're feeling. Because 2 days means it's not clear cut. 2 days means that there may be a verdict that you don't want to hear. There's a jury of 10 men, 2 women. When they return, they find Brown guilty of Alex and Leah's murders. It must have been hard. Like I said, it's no easy feat convicting somebody of murder when there is no body and no confession. And they did that. Power and props to them. You only need reasonable doubt. And there is nothing more doubtful than not having a physical body. Bear that in mind. You've got a man saying there was a tragic accident. You've got a man saying that this woman's still alive. You've got no evidence really to say that she's absolutely been killed by him, and yet they went for it. And like I say, power to them. Let their consciences be clean. Let them be assured they made the right decision. He made absolutely no reaction when the verdict was announced. If I'd have been in there, I'd have been cheerleading. Sometimes I feel that would be helpful and appropriate. You know, just a small cheerlead, maybe with a couple of your mates. Pom-poms, definitely. Maybe dressed in more of a stripy type outfit with the number of years they're going down for on your chest, that kind of thing. That's how I'd look at it. Just think it's a good idea. Throwing it out there, again, makes court a little bit less intimidating, more fun. Sorry. Obviously, murder cases are not fun, but the idea of doing a cheerleading rift with the number of years on my chest, on my t-shirt, that would actually be something relatively thrilling. And don't pretend you're not all imagining what you would do. And also thinking about joining my troop, which might be something I consider in the future. We get to the 13th of January, 2023. This is when he's going to get sentenced. He's 41 years of age at this moment in time. And at Hove Crown Court, people are waiting to listen to the amount of years that he's going to get. That bastard, he didn't even go to the hearing. He refused. He remained in his prison cell. And let me tell you this. It's a personal feeling. How dare his human rights matter in that moment. Alex and Leah have been murdered. 5 children have lost their mothers. And that excuse for a human being believes that he has a right not to go to court and listen to the victim impact statements of the families who were affected. I don't care about his human rights. You know what? You lose your human rights when you murder innocent people. You lose your human rights when you lie and extend the agony of the family who have to deal with the loss and demise of their loved ones. You lose your rights when a child wakes up in the night crying because they want their mummy and their mummy's never going to come back to them because they were taken and stolen by you. You don't get your human rights when every one of those kids is never going to have their mother by their side at their weddings. When they have their own children, they're denied that future. So your human rights mean nothing. How they did not drag him from his prison cell by force, I have no idea. I think it's a topsy-turvy world where people like this are afforded a right to do that. So the victim impact statements he didn't even have to listen to, essentially. Now, Judge Nicholas Hilliard, they concluded that the standard required for a full life tariff had not been met. Oh, God. Oh, my God. How does this happen? Seriously, how does this happen? Judge Nicholas Hilliard, why was it not allowed a full life sentence? Why? Why? Why would you want this piece of SHIT ever having the potential of walking our streets again? This is a serial killer. What do you need to be a serial killer? You need to have killed two or more people at separate points with a cooling off period. He meets that definition perfectly. And yet, he doesn't deserve a full life tariff. Now, when he sentences him, he sentences him to life and he gives him a minimum term of 49 years. So I appreciate that at the end of the day, this guy is not going to be walking our streets, hopefully, hopefully. But what I do know is that we should never even take a risk of that potential. And also, what's the messaging to the children and the families? When you consider what happened to Alex and Leah, when you consider this man is a serial killer, why didn't he get a full life sentence? As far as I'm concerned, he absolutely meets the level that's required to achieve that kind of tariff. Now, the judge referred to the violent sexual nature of his crimes, said Brown had been preying on his victim's vulnerability and that his conscience is untroubled by what he's done. I think we can all agree with that, Judge. I think we all know that it's untroubled by what he's done because he did it again, didn't he? We don't really need that. What we need is to be told he's never, ever going to have a hope of freedom. Now, after the hearing, Leah's sister, Zara, where she spoke of the horrific impact of losing her sister, she said, "Losing my sister has been the most destroying and devastating experience you can imagine. A perverted psychopath has preyed on my sister and taken advantage of her loneliness. She'll never have the chance to see her children again." How do you explain that to children aged between 6 and 12 years, that they'll never get to see their mother again? She's absolutely right. It's absolutely correct. And Leah's mother said this: "She will leave a huge hole in her children's lives. I have sudden surges of mental and physical pain where I realise I won't see her again. The pain is so hard to bear. And I can't imagine what it would be like to lose a child. I'm sure every single one of us, whether we have children or not, can empathise with the enormity of that agony." Now, she also went on to criticise Brown's very sadistic behaviour in just going ahead and refusing to admit the fact that he killed Leah. The fact that he'd refused to disclose the location of her body. He went out of his way to retain that level of control. There's not even been an opportunity for them to have closure. They can't bring her body to a funeral. And again, that's stolen from her children because they have nowhere to go with the grief that will haunt them for a lifetime. Bear in mind though, it's what we expect of Brown. It's what you get in psychopathic mindsets like his. Highly narcissistic, highly controlling. I'm going to retain control even after I've gone to prison. Which is why I think prison is so too good for so many people. You can't rehabilitate these individuals. Why should they be fed 3 times a day? Why should they be afforded human rights when all they wish to do is make others suffer? You know what? If you're not going to tell us where the body is, if you're not going to admit your guilt, then there's going to be issues that you face whilst you're inside. You're not going to be given privileges. You're going to be basic in your experience. Those kind of things actually would have power. But we're so lost these days, even with predators like this, in not realizing that sometimes, not always, I'm a massive believer in rehabilitation, believe me, amen to rehabilitation, but not in these cases. and not when they're controlling the families who've gone through a fundamental catastrophic loss and not being allowed to bring their human home because the predator, lying in a cell, eating food that's paid for by us, refuses to disclose that information. Why should they not therefore be on the most basic rations and the most uncomfortable experience in their cell? That would give them an incentive to actually think about their narcissistic needs and to come good with the information the family so dearly deserve. Just as if you don't go to court and you don't listen to those victim impact statements, then you lose your privileges. Genuinely, that's what should happen. Now, Alex's family, they actually felt really impressed with the police. And you know me, I'm the first to criticise when we need lessons learned and all those things. But at the end of the day, they felt that the police and the CPS really worked hard. They prosecuted Brown and they went out of their way to make sure that Alex got her justice. I mean, it's a cold justice because Alex should have been able to go home to her family and she's never been able to physically do that. As a human being, not in this universe at least, not in this lifetime, but at least the fact that they know what happened, they have some closure for that level, that's really important. The family stated this, we will never get over this or move on, but in time, we will learn to live with the loss of Alex. So true, when you have a traumatic loss, a loss of any time, but a traumatic loss is a little bit like grief on steroids. It's an agonizing wound that feels so intolerable that at times you believe it will consume and drown you. And actually, the idea of it consuming and drowning you feels preferable to existing with the feeling. But in the end, you kind of just get used to the pain. You adapt to it. And even though that doesn't resolve it, it means that you can continue. And I really hope that Alex's family and particularly her children find joy and meaning and future and live the life fully that she can no longer live. Now, before I finish today's video, I'm going to tell you my fear. And I do have some fear about this case. And I'm sure that a lot of you listening have probably been thinking this throughout this video. But certainly for me, it's really resonated. It really has, because I have a deep fear. I have a deep fear that Brown has likely killed more women that we don't even know about. He was very organised. Bear in mind, one of the women's bodies was not found. You can't get more organised than that. He targeted vulnerable victims. He targeted sex workers. So he went for people that are easily accessible, people who were less likely to be missed. I appreciate where Leah and Alex are concerned. They were much loved. They were much missed. But that's potentially the distinction for these women, that they were loved, that they were missed. And that's why he was brought to justice, particularly when you look at Alex and how instinctual she was and how protective she was about her personal security and how she actually led that breadcrumb trail really to solving both murders without a doubt. So it's her nous, her genuine connection with things feeling a little bit concerning and off that enabled the police to actually uncover this case. That's what's so powerful about this, because what I'm really talking about, in spite of the amazing police work, the CPS work, talking about Alex solving her own murder, but what's distinct about these women is they were cared for, and that's his mistake. And what if he was going for women before this who weren't missed? What if he was finding people who didn't have families, who wouldn't be noticed? The amount of people who go missing every single year is terrifying. And with human predators like this, so adept at removing bodies, destroying bodies, so effective at being organized in how they procure victims, it makes you wonder whether we're dealing with someone who's far more extensive in their killing and the history of killing than we're talking about today. Think about it. He had the twisted motive. He had the opportunity, given that he rented that land at Littlebridge Farm. Wouldn't be surprised at all if what I'm really talking about today is a man who in time will discover is a prolific serial killer. I hope not, but I suspect that I'm right. And I'm sure that many of you also have had the same suspicions as I've been telling you this story today. Let me know your thoughts. Do you think that he only murdered two and that Alex thwarted his opportunity and potential to go on and kill many more? Do you think that the police should be looking at other disappearances in the area of individuals who are vulnerable or from around the area and looking at whether there is a potential that the paths crossed with Brown? It really reminds me of Gary Allen. If you haven't watched my Gary Allen coverage, please do, because again, I think that he is a serial killer who killed many more women, and we just haven't caught up with the amount of corpses or the amount of information that's required to solve those cases. But it tells the same story again and again, doesn't it? That these women of great meaning to the world, because of their less connected links, often can just disappear without a trace, and no one really cares. It's something our society has to do better at, because every human being has meaning. Aside from the person like Brown I'm talking about today, we can certainly discount those individuals as human.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.